Connection.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
And we are glad you're here. We're live today. Yes, we will take calls. For those of you who want to call and say how wonderful we are, or complain because you don't like
either
what we're
way.
Doing. Either way, yeah. We'll get to some calls later on. Lorene, how are you?
I'm great. I am. We got lots to talk about in news for Jews this week. So some of the biggies.
Well, yes. Why don't we? Do you want to start with what you were just talking about on NPR, the annexation, the Israeli election?
Oh, sure.
I mean, they just were talking. It's top of mind.
Yeah, top of mind. So there's a lot going on with Israel right now. Obviously, the elections, the Israeli elections, are 2 days away. We will actually have a reporter on next week who will give us a recap on the election results. So a couple interesting things. Bibi Netanyahu was announcing the other day annexation of particular settlements within the West Bank. That's, you know, that territory that's west of the Jordan River. There is a lot of consternation around that. There's a lot of people within Israel that are very concerned about that, as well as here in the U.S.
I was saying the U.S., and I am one of them. Now, yeah. As you know, I've said this on the air. I dislike Netanyahu. I think he is antithetical to the peace process. I think he is the worst thing that has happened to Israel, and I think he's a crook. Other than that, he's a great guy. He speaks English very well. And, I mean, he's under indictment by the Attorney General of Israel. And
right.
I think that if he is reelected and does that annexation, that Israel will lose a lot of support in the United States because it will scuttle the two-state solution without a doubt.
Tell us how you feel, Mike.
I'm trying to hold back.
So I would actually have a couple comments on that. I mean, first of all, I don't think that Bibi Netanyahu has been antithetical to the peace process. In fact, I think where he stands on security measures is very consistent with the Israeli population. Even when you're looking at the other parties running, the Blue and White Party, et cetera, there's really no longer a far left party in Israel. Really, pretty much everyone is centrist. Even Netanyahu's opponents agree with him and have historically in past elections on the security issues ever since the second intifada. And the biggest problem with that, and the biggest reason, I guess I should say that has caused that, is that there is not a peace partner on the other side. And instead you have regular, insightful statements being made by Abbas in the West Bank and, of course, Hamas in Iran acting in Gaza. So
they're all knuckleheads.
But I will never give the moral equivalency of what Israel has done to calling for, mass murders and suicide bombings and launching missiles into Israel to kill civilians. I mean, there's no comparison to that. So on that part, I mean, just to disagree with you on that, I don't think he's been the worst thing for Israel. I don't think he's antithetical to peace. I think what he understands is what he's trying to do is keep his nation secure. On the annexation issue, It was, as a friend of mine recently just said, provocative. However, the idea of annexing certain settlements within that territory and swapping in exchange for other Arab settlements that are within the Israeli territory has been part of the regular dialogue of a lot of the different, of the last, 10 years, and when they would come together for peace process and conversations, even the Obama administration under the Bush administration, the concept of there are certain settlements within that area that are Israeli that are, just have been there for a long time that are traditional settlements. Some of them predated the 1948 state. The idea that those would come into Israel and that there were certain territories that were within Israel that would actually be part of the Palestinian Authority. So that had always been part of the conversation, discussion.
But don't you think if that happens that the two-state solution is dead?
Well, right now, I think conversation...
Not that it's going along fabulously right now, of course.
Look,
yeah, right.
I think all of us are just dreaming if we think that there's any potential of having a conversation on any peace right now until we have somebody on the other side that we can actually have dialogue with. That's our problem. I mean, I don't think that the two-state solution is dead, but I think right now there's just no one to speak with. So do I think it's, causing a lot of discussion within Israel right now? Yes. Do I think it's going to cause a lot of concerns here in the States? Absolutely. I think a lot of people are looking at this. Why are we doing this? Is this helping our situation? Quite frankly, nobody's ever going to be positive anytime anything that Israel does. I think anytime Israel tries to take a step for security or to move forward, there's always going to be criticism. I mean, you know, she was criticized after she took over Gaza and didn't want to take over Gaza, but did the swap with Egypt and gave the Sinai back to Egypt. Egypt said, well, great, I don't want to have to take care of security for Gaza. You take Gaza. Israel did. Israel withdrew in 2005, sent troops in to remove their own people who were living there, and is still criticized. And people still don't even recognize the legitimate border that exists between Israel and Gaza, and they're causing a peaceful protest. It's not. These are people in Gaza, particularly Hamas militants, that are attacking her border regularly.
Well, I mean, even Netanyahu, there was an attack, a rocket attack, the other day when Netanyahu was at a campaign rally.
Right, in southern Israel, in Ashkelon and Ashdod, exactly, right. Going into civilian territories. And this is part of the problem. I mean, it has to be part of the discussion. I think, you know, politics are politics. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu is a politician. I'm sure the statement was made specifically to help him with a particular segment of the population. Does it help long term? No. But again, I think it's been part of that discussion that's been out there for over 10 years about these swappings of different settlements. So I don't know that it's as provocative, as new of an idea as the media at least portrays it. I think it's just sort of front of mind because he raises kind of a political stunt at the last minute, which I don't think is helpful to make those things a political issue.
Think he's going to win? I know. Do you think he's going to win?
You know, he might. Really close. I mean, all the polls I keep seeing, I mean, he and Benny Gantz are neck and neck. And I will tell you, so Benny Gantz is definitely represents the moderate centrist view of Israel.
Right. He's not leftist. There's no, we saw him at AIPAC when we were there in whenever it was.
Exactly. But but the thing about Benny Gantz, you know, is, you know, his mother was a Holocaust survivor. He's obviously a former general. Agrees with Bibi Netanyahu on security issues. However, he the one area where he, for instance, disagrees, where Bibi Netanyahu has shown restraint, is with Hamas in Gaza. Benny Gantz I would be substantially more tough on Hamas and their attacks in Gaza. He would be swift and more detrimental in the blows. And he's made that clear. So,
and I have no problem with that. No.
And so there you go. But it should be a really interesting election. I will say the four Arab parties, just as we're talking about the elections, the four Arab parties did not have a unified bloc in the last election, which was April, May. They have unified. They have done a unified bloc for this election. So it will be interesting to see if, you know, and I think their point there is get their voice heard. There's always a coalition government in Israel. I think what they're looking to do is have a seat in that coalition government. And they're saying if we could be a unified bloc, we have a greater chance of being part of that coalition government, whatever it will end up being.
And what you said is so insightful. When you talk about the Arab bloc, when people talk about Israel suppressing the views of minorities, well, that's just not true. An Arab bloc, members of the Knesset that are Arabs, member of the Supreme Court, that's an Arab. So when people talk and say that Israel just suppresses everybody's views who aren't Jewish, that's just not true.
Right. And, you know, and it also goes to my point of the political parties. I mean, they got four political parties. They are very active in the political process within Israel. So other things that were going on politically this week that this goes to sort of, I think, what we were talking about at the end of the show last week. So this really concerns me. Two of the top three candidates on the Democratic presidential ticket right now are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, the two senators. And both of them have made choices to put individuals on their campaign staff, meaning as key advisors, people who believe that Israel is illegitimate and racist, support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel. And, you know, I think this says it all. And I think in the Warren camp, the individual, his name is Max Berger. He is one of the founders of the organization, If Not Now. On the Bernie Sanders campaign, Linda Sarsour was specifically announced this week as a surrogate for the Sanders 2020 presidential campaign. And I've talked about her multiple times on this show and how she has been you know, has engaged in anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Zionist rhetoric for years, and why she's offensive to many in the Jewish community. And I think that, you know, she made this statement, which to me is very telling. You know, she says that she believes in a foreign policy that sees Palestinians as human beings deserving of human rights and self-determination. And what she really means by that is that the opposite, meaning everybody else doesn't believe in that, that the establishment doesn't believe in that, Israel doesn't believe in that. And that is a lie. I mean, you know, as Jews, I cannot imagine not believing and supporting in self-determination, human dignity, human rights for any human being. You know, it's just, and so the idea that that is something that exists, again, it's just spreading the falsehood and lies. And so what I think at the end of the day, what's going to happen, and while people may not be paying that much attention to these two individuals now, I personally believe that should one of them be nominated as a Democratic presidential candidate, I do believe that the 70% of Jews who traditionally vote Democrat, that this changes the conversation, that this is, you know, all of a sudden we have someone on the main stage for the first time since Israel has been a recognized state in this world, you know, in our modern days, a presidential candidate who is openly saying, you know, I don't have people saying, I don't believe Israel is legitimate.
You know, and I understand what you're saying, but I don't think Israel, no, the polls show, Israel is not top of mind for Jewish voters. It is not number one. And if there was a candidate, a Republican candidate who wasn't Trump, I think there'd be some credibility there. I don't think that Trump's Trump, quite frankly, with Jewish voters. But so it is. I don't think that Bernie nor Elizabeth Warren would be terrific for Israel.
Right, but I think it's a game changer for Democrats.
I do,
because even though Israel's not a number one issue, Jewish Democrats in this country, we've never been confronted. I mean, because we've had the support of Democrats in Congress. We've never had a front runner on the Democratic presidential ticket with such a strong anti-Israel position. And that, I think, you know, I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, you know,
it's obviously an important issue to raise up. And in that same vein, before I came here to the studio this morning, I saw Ilhan Omar on Face the Nation. She is smooth. I want to tell you, she talked very low key, and they asked, do you still support BDS? And I do, but she deflected very well. This woman, although people say she's an idiot,
she's
not an idiot.
No, anybody, she's very politically savvy.
Anybody who says that the four, the squad, is comprised of a bunch of idiots, they're being idiotic and not recognizing strength of this. I was impressed. I don't mean this in a good way, but I was impressed about how smoothly she was able to deflect the questions. And this woman is polished.
I've watched her since she was on the campaign trail, and she was very politically savvy then. I don't think that's changed. I think she's a lot more polished than Representative Tlaib or Representative Ocasio-Cortez,
I don't know if I'd agree with Ocasio-Cortez. I think than Tlaib, yes, she's much more polished than. Ocasio-Cortez is really smart.
I think she's made some pretty foolish decisions. I don't know that I say that she's smart. I think that she's politically savvy.
Yeah.
And she's gotten smarter about having the right advisors around her, I think, since she's been elected. But who knows? But that's a whole other, but let's talk about some other interesting things.
All right.
Lots of things. So
you want to talk sports?
Sports. Oh, we got some good sports stories.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Well, first the baseball team. How is the baseball team?
The Israeli baseball team.
Who knew?
Who knew? Yeah, you know, it's a short book about Jewish baseball players. It's, you know,
right.
You got Sandy Koufax. There's a couple here and there, but yeah, it is not
baseball.
Baseball been very, very good to me. No, it's not been in many Jewish baseball players. Although my high school was 80% Jewish, so we were all Jewish on the baseball team for the most part.
But that's a rarity.
But that's in Chicago or in Skokie where I grew up.
Right.
Yeah.
So Israel's baseball team has been advancing pretty quickly in the early Olympic qualifying tournament.
I know.
And apparently this time, this is like one of the first Israeli baseball teams that's actually made up mostly of actual Israelis. So I never knew that we had baseball in Israel, but there you go.
I have a friend.
You learn something new every day.
We've got to get him on. He has a website, and I can't remember what it is. I've got to track it down, that tracks every professional Jewish baseball player,
really?
Major leagues, minor leagues, and he updates it every day. Like you know, if Abby Cohn hit 3 home runs yesterday, he's got it in his, even if he's in playing in double A or triple A.
Is this an app? Does he have an app?
Does
he really?
Yeah, well, or it's a website. I can't remember. He's got a whole different job that's involved in journalism, but we'll have to get him on. It's pretty fascinating, you know?
Baseball day.
Yeah, maybe we can call Sandy Koufax, you know?
Jewish baseball day, so yeah. But then the other story I thought was really nice. So this is coming out from, what's his name? Anthony Davidson, who is a dean of Fordham School of Professional and Continuing Studies in the Bronx. He is the son of Holocaust survivors. He is holding a conference. He wants to hold a conference to fight anti-Semitism in sports, which is at the top of his agenda in an upcoming New York conference, which I thought was really interesting. And what he focused on was soccer. And I'm kind of glad that he did this, because when we sometimes watch some of the European soccer games, there's horrific anti-Semitism that's expressed by the Europeans, which I think for many Americans, they thought it would be just, this stuff wouldn't happen in America. And if it did, there'd probably be kicked out of games.
In soccer game? No, I don't watch that much soccer.
Soccer.
No, I understand with the little ball, the white and the black and all that. I get it. No, what happens? I have never seen that.
Oh, wow. So there's a lot of times where Jewish players or Israelis, because they've got a great soccer team, but they're playing in the EU, they'll make the hissing sound of the gas chambers.
Really?
They'll hold up, big, signs about, go back to the Holocaust. And so I'm just really horrific.
I've never seen that. But I don't watch a lot of soccer.
So in this one article, it was in Allgemeine, I was talking about, Anthony was being interviewed, and he was talking about some of the really disconcerting things that are happening in Europe around soccer. And he said, so this is a quote from him. He goes, but a lot of it, especially in Eastern Europe and also incredibly in Italy, is absolutely mind-blowing. He says, in a sense that you can have a banner that is almost the size of an entire section of a stadium in Italy at a game, and it will say on its massive letters, Jews to the ovens. And so this is what you see happening at some of these soccer games in Europe, in Eastern Europe. And this just goes back to that deepening concern that we have about this rebirth of anti-Semitism in Europe, and starting to see it grow here again in the United States. But this is real. This is very real, what's happening in the soccer world.
And as you say, through Europe, I mean, this week you found this story about the swastika on the Chapel of the Commonwealth War Grave Cemetery in the Netherlands.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, in Europe, it is very disconcerting. Even when we were in Ireland earlier this year, there were big signs. I guess it was in Northern Ireland. Free the Palestinians. There were walls painted that it had all anti-Semitic tropes on them. Right. Very Palestinian oriented.
Right.
So in Europe, I didn't think of Ireland as a place where it would, but it's just spreading through Eastern Europe. Yeah, it's disconcerting.
You see, and so let's talk about Free Palestine. I guess this was spray painted during morning prayers earlier this week on a synagogue in Los Angeles. Somebody had spray painted in red letters, Free Palestine. And the ADL came out and commented on it, and it sort of really hit it on the, you blame all Jews around the world for conduct that you think is not proper or policies in Israel. I mean, that really is anti-Semitic, and it's terror. It's hate. It's a hate crime, and what it's really intended to do is to terrorize Jews, here in the States or wherever they are. I mean, the idea is really terror.
There's another thing in this country going on. I mean, we can just go through a whole list of things. At the University of Tennessee, did you see that thing where it said Jews did 9/11? It's just incredible.
And the problem with it is that you can go on Google and you could just find some of the most crazy articles and things about Holocaust survivors and accusing Jews of everything. It's like the same thing. Yes, we know Jews control Hollywood. They control the financial markets. They're responsible for 9/11. They control that. I mean, give me a break. I mean, it's you can find. If you are wanting to have a reason to hate Jews, you can go on and find any type of propaganda stuff that you...
What I found upsetting, though, obviously, that is just terrible, but apparently the University of Tennessee is not jumping in and doing much to try to stem this, try to discover who was involved in it. That's so abhorrent that the university would just go, well, you know, it just sort of happens. Listen, what we have to do, though, because we've got a guest, and we're going to do some calls, we need to take a break, and we'll be right back, okay? This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. Now, here are three things that classic cars are good for. Turning heads at stoplights, making your neighbors jealous, and huge repair bills. But is it worth the cost? Maybe you should just give the classic car to WMNF. Call 888-966-3885 or go to WMNF.org. And thanks for being a classic listener. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I am Mike Deason.
And this is Lorene Jaffe.
Well, that's so demure for you.
It's very quiet.
Yeah, quiet is not a word I would use to describe.
Right, exactly. I was just quickly.
I'm sorry. That's got a snort from me. I was just.
So we got a guest with us. He's live in the studio. We will come back and chat a little bit about Iran after him and respond to one or two emails. There were some comments that came in that I'll give a quick response to before we do some calls later. But for now, really excited. So we have Jack Ross with us. Jack Ross is the former executive director of the Tampa JCCs and Federation. He is also the former executive director of the Florida Israel Business Accelerator. When he was with us at the Tampa Federation JCC, he actually helped building that FIBA program and then helped run it for a little over a year before moving on to his new role through a company that actually went through that process, and that is STEMRAD. And he is now the Vice President of North American Sales for STEMRAD. And he's here to talk to us today about that company, what they're doing. They're doing some pretty exciting things with the International Space Station, with Florida, between Florida and Israel, and so some fun stuff going on. So welcome, Jack.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Jack, I think you got to punch that button right over there. Try it again. There you are. Yeah, hey.
Good morning.
He's with us.
All right. So, Jack, let's, because you have the overview from the inside of a corporation that's working with FIBA, but also you helped establish it. Explain how that whole thing worked.
Sure.
Came together.
Sure. First, let me take a moment and thank the two of you and Mark Siegel, your producer, in creating such a wonderful format for the community. It's a wonderful voice of back and forth on very difficult issues relating to the Jewish community and to the community in the diaspora and to Israel itself. It's important. It's a part of an important conversation, and I just want to thank you, and the feedback that I get about the show is just wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a good time.
Right. By the way, just so our listeners know, that's the first time he's ever said that to me. And he and I are friends. So thank you, Jack.
No, of course. No, STEMRAD, I hope, is viewed here in Tampa as a real success story for a process that was birthed out of the development first of the Brian Glazer Family JCC, and that is the platform of the Florida Israel Business Accelerator. A soft landing platform, the first ever community-based platform of its kind that is intended to assist Israeli high-tech companies who have minimally viable products, customers in Israel, and who are ready to enter into the North American market, help with that launch. Whether it's strategic alignments, it's professional services, whether it's acculturation, things are done differently in the United States and in North America, generally. And so FIBA was established in 2017, really in 2016, prior to the opening of the Glazer JCC. And it has gone on subsequent to my involvement to grow beyond. I think the original vision has brought in over, 60 companies to Tampa. And there are wonderful success stories, one of which STEMRAD is just one.
And, okay, tell us about, now, I did an interview with Oren Milstein, right, who's the mm-hmm. president of STEMRAD. Back a couple of years ago, I did a freelance project for WEDU on Synapse, the big Vinick mm-hmm. put together thing. And Mark Blumenthal, too, who was right. very involved in that. Tell me what STEMRAD does. It's a pretty unique corporation.
It is. It has developed the only technology of its kind in the world. We are a radiation protection company, meaning we have developed technologies to safeguard an individual, whether it's here on Earth or in space, or in a cath lab, from the dangers of ionizing radiation. In each of those environments, it's a different type of radiation. And before the advent of our technology, an individual, with the exception of in a cath lab, there's been no way to safeguard that person from the exposure to ionizing radiation, and thereby limiting what men can and women can do in space. Or
but even in a Chernobyl situation,
right.
the people that went in to clean up Chernobyl, I understand the death rate was just skyrocketing for the workers that were cleaning it up, and this would protect them. Correct.
That's right. Of the 24 first responders that perished in Chernobyl, at least 22 of them we are quite confident would have been alive today. And probably the other two. And actually, it was the subsequent catastrophe in Fukushima, which was the genesis of Dr. Oren Milstein's work in this area and developing the shielding that he did.
Amazing. So one of the things that they are currently working on, which is some pretty exciting projects, is for the International Space Station, the ASTRORAD. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because there's definitely some very exciting facts around that for our local Tampa community.
Sure. So STEMRAD operates in five verticals: military, first responder, soon to be the medical vertical, in the nuclear space, and in space itself. And as I mentioned earlier, there are different types of ionizing radiation in space. Our astronauts, as they return for the first time since 1972, they face a different type of challenge as you would in Earth. It's that of intermittent solar particle events and background galactic rays. So our astronauts in the prior early NASA years in the 70s were on short duration missions. They did not encounter a solar particle event that would have put their lives at risk. It was quite fortuitous that they didn't. But it is expected as NASA now enters back into deep space, that is beyond Earth's lower orbit where the space station resides and within the protective realm of the Van Allen belts, our magnetosphere that protects all of us from radiation in space. Where humankind is now headed back through the NASA program to the moon and beyond to Mars. And it's without question that the astronauts will be exposed during these long duration events to solar particle events and higher level of galactic rays.
So is this incorporated in the spacesuits that they wear, or is it a special? Because I saw a video where the guys were wearing protective things, but it looked like if you're going to be in space for days upon days and then months maybe, that wouldn't be. Is it incorporated in the spacesuits? Huh?
That's right. So it's not incorporated in the spacesuits as you would understand them, being outside of the capsule. So inside of a human-rated capsule headed, again, to the moon and beyond, you'll have astronauts who are doing as they are on the space station today, conducting experiments and brushing their teeth and sleeping and working out and doing everything that a human being will and must do as we head back into deep space. When the onboard computers and sensors detect oncoming solar storm, they will be able to don this vest and protect their most vital organs, those organs most susceptible to ionizing radiation. And such an event could last an hour or it could last 2 weeks. And so while they will have a protective shelter to go into for an hour duration, they certainly can't withstand a two-week duration in a box. And so this shield will enable them to continue their critical work, continue their functioning in day-to-day lives, and yet preserve their lives.
Okay, and so this is the shield that's being tested that's going to be launching soon to the International Space Station, correct?
Correct. So we have two missions coming up. The first is on October 21st at 2:39 p.m. We're launching from the Wallops Island NASA launch site in Virginia, near Virginia Beach. And
I've been there. I used to live in Norfolk. So okay, yeah, that's a very cool place.
Very cool. We're headed out there to the launch, by the way.
And you'll be at the
We'll be at the launch. And the Shield is going up to the International Space Station and will be tested by a female astronaut. Now, a female is important because the ovaries and the breast tissue are more susceptible than other tissues in organs in our body. And so a female astronaut will be donning the vest. And for 6 to 8 months, we'll be going through human factor and day-to-day comfort examination of the Shield. And we'll report notes. This is, you know, doesn't allow me to move here, and it's itching here, and it's a little tight there, and it's some of the practical aspects of the Shield. And this is in preparation, while the space station itself is not susceptible to the ionizing radiation in deep space, it gives the opportunity for the astronauts in a zero gravity environment to ergonomically test the Shield. A year from this October, although October is not the date in 2020, I think it's more November, and that can change, we'll be headed up on the Artemis 1 mission, NASA's first return to deep space since 1972. And here, the Israeli Space Agency, in partnership with the German Space Agency and NASA, we'll be testing the radiation protection factors that will safeguard our astronauts headed into space as we head to the moon. And there'll be two phantoms, or dummies, if you will.
You're not talking about Lorene and me.
No.
I'm sorry.
Those two phantoms will have actual human skeletal core with polymers that approximate human tissue. And we'll each have about 5,600 decimeters in each of the phantoms. One will don our shield, donated by the Israeli Space Agency. The phantoms are donated by the German Space Agency, actually. Mm-hmm. And the other will be naked, Helga and Zelga, I believe are the names. And at the end of that mission, which goes 70,000 miles beyond the moon, and then we'll return to Earth, and in addition to testing other systems in preparation for our travels to Mars, it will be the final sort of kick the road, tires on the road test of the efficacy of the Astrorad, which has passed all of its testing in simulation. And we have every reason to believe will ultimately be NASA's enabling technology for human-rated return travel and its return to deep space.
To Mars. So tell us that little fun fact that we have regarding the insignia that will be on the Astrorad for the International Space Station.
Yeah, we have two very cool things that are connected with this launch to ISS in October. And there's a nexus to Tampa in two very important ways.
Yes.
First of all, what adorns the Astrorad shield is the American and Israeli flag. Now, this will constitute the first time the Israeli flag will have been on the International Space Station since its development. So it's a milestone of pride for the company, for our community as the Jewish community, and for the State of Israel. Second, the Lightning logo is on the shield, and we're excited about that as well because it's really a nexus to innovation and safety. And here in STEMRAD's innovation, together with Lockheed Martin, by the way, they're our partner company in developing the Astrorad, has used technology and innovation to create a safer environment for our astronauts. And that's being done in sports also with innovation. And so there's a nexus here.
You know, they said hockey wouldn't work in Tampa. Maybe it'll work on Mars.
Although hockey is working in Tampa.
No, it is. But when it first came in there.
Right. Yeah. But I love this. So we know that Jeff Finnick has been one of the early investors in STEMRAD. So it's really exciting to hear that, you know, Tampa Bay, our local community, that we have a piece of that on the Astronaut Rad going to the International Space Station.
It goes a little beyond that. As you may both know, in 2005, the city of Tampa entered into a sister city relationship with the city of Ashdod, a city 40 kilometers south of Tel Aviv. It's a port city with a very similar demographic of about 300,000 people.
Just north of, and it's just north of Gaza. We were talking about rockets that were launched.
That's right. It's 24 kilometers north of Gaza, and was the scene of what Bibi Netanyahu was speaking.
The rocket's coming in, right.
And within the context of our sister city relationship, we are developing programs with STEM students, science and space-oriented middle school students, both on the Ashdod side and in the Tampa Bay side, that are working together now in developing a program on the study of radiation dangers in space and how innovation can overcome dangers in space or elsewhere. And we hope to have, although the launch falls on Yontif, we hope to have an inaugural program with the kids where they are watching online a stream, whether it be live for the secular kids on the Tampa side or on the Israeli side, and that this becomes a platform for a more substantive STEM project regarding radiation that ties into a lightning night, which has yet to be developed. We're still in very early talks, but that the lightning will highlight their logo being on the station and the study of STEM and radiation, and that we have a contest where children of middle school age develop a project, and the winner on the Tampa side may, we hope, go to Israel, and that the Israeli winner will come to Tampa. So we're trying to take a Tampa Israeli company with a critical innovation for humankind, with a nexus to both Israel and Tampa, or Ashdod and Tampa, and connected to communal activity, to our sense of pride for the lightning in the state of Israel and American ingenuity, and wrap it all together in corporate involvement and responsibility. And so I'm very proud to be part of STEMRAD in every way, and I'm just thrilled that it's an outgrowth of the FIBA project, the outgrowth of the new JCC project, and the outgrowth of even really your work here in this new programming. I mean, our community is so dynamic now and changing in so many ways. So I'm very happy to share that.
I have one more question. We're almost out of time on this. But when I talked to Oren a couple of years ago, he was also working to develop something for radiologists with Bruce Wybell, a local radiologist. Is that program still up and running?
Oh, yeah. We've completed our Alpha 1 test at Tampa General. Mm-hmm. We're now in October. We'll engage in our Alpha 2 test at four hospitals. And we are set to introduce in January in Miami at a very large interventional radiologist conference, a game-changing solution that will not only increase efficacy for cath lab interventional radiology across the spectrum, but also address a very significant orthopedic problem that accompanies their current solutions. And we think that this will be a watershed for the company and for their industry.
Jack, wow. Thank you so much. This was just fascinating. I hope you come back again.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
Okay, this is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. We're going to take some calls next. Terry, I know you've been hanging in there a long time. Hang with us. We'll get right to you. Did you know that the Circle of Friends is the best way to support 88.5 WMNF? Monthly supporters are really, they're the backbone of WMNF. Give online today at WMNF.org or during the weekdays, business hours, call 813-238-8001. And thanks. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorraine Jaffe.
You're grooving to the music.
I am.
Makes me happy, you know. I wrote that song.
Yes, I know. It's good. It's good. I mean, I liked our first one because I love the klezmer, and then this one's also fun. So we're going to just chat about two quick little things, okay. I think, and then we're going to take calls. So for those who want to call in, 813-239-9663. So first, I just thought we had to mention Iran. So a couple things around Iran, and this week. Obviously, Iran used drones through the Houthis that they fund and sponsor in Yemen that are trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard to direct missiles into Saudi Arabia this week. Those were the same drones that Israel knocked out in Syria that Iran was going to use for very similar direct strikes within Israel that could have resulted in mass casualties. And so just a point on that, I thought it was also interesting this week that the Iranian general, you know, says that they're ready for full-fledged war with the United States. I don't think Iran actually is going to be doing that. I do think that they are trying to push the buttons. There was five direct attacks by Iran and Israel in the month of August. August. I think the most frightening thing that just came to light was that we know that Iran is the primary sponsor of Hezbollah in Lebanon. The leader of Hezbollah reports directly to the supreme leader in Iran. And Israel just recently identified a factory that Hezbollah was building in Lebanon for precision-guided munitions. And that is an alarm, right? Because Hezbollah has about 150,000 missiles on the northern border of Israel ready to launch at any moment into Israel. You add some GPS and some precision-guided technology onto that. I mean, they could be very specific, striking the Knesset, you know, city parks, you know, the Supreme Court, just the main downtown area of Tel Aviv when you think about that.
Fortunately, there's a defense system in Israel.
But not one that could take out 110,000 missiles. I mean, that's impossible. So I think this is probably the most alarming news I think that's come out from the next week regarding Iran. So, and then quickly, there was an email that we got. Somebody was angry because Rabbi had made a comment about the swastikas at UCF. First of all, just to go back, Mike and I have talked about USF. Yes, there were anti-Semitic posters plastered on the Hillel student sign at University of South Florida. We were not talking about UCF, but University of South Florida. And yes, there has been growing activity by two white supremacist groups at USF who have been passing out flyers around the campus. And so, yes, that Mike did not make Mike told the truth. I mean, I think there might have been a misstatement about UCF, but no, those were very accurate statements.
And we did not say UCF.
Right, okay. But I want to make sure that we responded to that.
Okay.
So let's take calls.
All right, Terry, thank you for waiting so long. You are on the air.
Yes, you can call me the first Jew.
Okay.
Listen, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on with people because they're not like the other people. And I'm talking to you because you're my people. If you understand that the original people were the original people, and that truth cannot be replaced. The fact is that if the original people and the other people look at the original people and the original people's pain, and they don't see that pain, they cannot feel that pain, they cannot understand that pain, then they will suffer the curse of the good God Almighty because you're not doing your duty. Now, Israel is a place, and it's a people. And that place and that people is buried throughout the earth. And Israel needs to get on their job and look at their other lost children and speak up when they see their pain, when they see their children being killed or hurt or being kept into a perpetual state of poverty, being told to make bricks without straw. You see that. You know what it means. So when you see that and you allow it to go on, and then there are people that are with our people. We the Jews, we stand and we watch this man Trump say that he is with Israel and he does these things and they're symbolic and they mean something to those who don't really understand that there's a greater picture here. Because if you're from God, if you're really the people of God, you're going to do godly things, which is right. And you have humanity in your heart. You don't want to see any suffering. You don't want to see any pain. You don't want to see any of God's children hurt. That's us. And that's the other children, too, because we're all made from God.
Terry, I agree.
I agree. Terry, I think part of the thing is that Jews have been susceptible to trying to help the downtrodden people of the world because we have had to deal with that as well through our lives. So we always try to look to help people who are being discriminated against and being unfairly targeted. And that's one of the things I love about being a Jew. Rob from Notice Sassa, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I had a couple of comments about why I think the progressives, the far left and in this country, have turned sort of away from Israel and embraced this boycott sanction movement. And one of it is that starting maybe back in the early 80s, prior to that, you know, during the Olympic debacle where all the athletes were killed and when all those terrorist attacks were happening inside Israel, I think there was a lot of sympathy for Israel from the left. Traditionally, I think there always has been. But when the right started to embrace Israel, maybe starting with Reagan, certainly on into Bush and into the present time, it's sort of like the friend of my enemy is my enemy. And So they began, I think, turn against Israel in that sense. Also, Israel is no longer seen as the David, you know, because it had the gall to actually defend itself and to build up its military and to build the wall separating itself from the people that were planting bombs in cafes. So all of a sudden, the so-called Palestinian Arabs were seen more so as the underdog, much like, say, Native Americans were, or much like blacks in America seen, you know. And I think all of those factors contribute to that slowly over time.
I think it's an interesting commentary. A couple of things. I think the far left, there's a difference between liberals and leftist progressive policies. The far left has actually always been just like the far right, has held anti-Israel views. The Democrats were actually very strong supporters of Israel, and I believe the majority of Democrats still to this day remain so. There's probably a lot of reasons for it. I mean, Israel has no choice but to defend herself, because if she didn't, she'd be annihilated every time. She's surrounded by enemies. She's 25 miles wide at one point. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny little piece of land. Just one comment on the wall, though. I mean, it was the second intifada under the PLO and Arafat.
Right.
So, it's not a wall. It's actually a security fence. It's only a wall for a small portion. To actually, I think less than 10% is an actual wall. And that's okay. But because a lot of people think that, oh, it's a wall and they build this apartheid. No, it's actually a security fence. And the reason for the security fence, and just so people listening understand, that security fence was opposed by the majority of Israelis, because Israelis and the Palestinians had worked together and were friends for so long. But during the Intifada, the suicide bombings had gotten so bad, and there was a final breaking point. There is an area, a town in Jerusalem that's right close to the border of Bethlehem. And what had happened at that time was there were two suicide bombers who had come in with a group of like over 100 people who were coming, walking over. They just walk over the hill and come into work. And that morning, they decided to get on a bus with school children and blow themselves up and blew up the children. And that was the breaking point for most Israelis saying, okay, we need a security fence. I mean, it's one thing you want to blow us up, you want to kill us, you want to, do those things, but now you're going after our little innocent children. And that was kind of the final straw. And I would say the portion that has the wall, which is very small, that wall is there because during the Intifada, there were snipers that were shooting people in their homes, men, women, children, at night, and people didn't feel safe, and they had no choice but to put up that small wall and that strip there to prevent the snipers. So there's a lot of misinformation that's out there, but I do agree with that whole Goliath David discussion. I don't know, if you're right about how it happened, but it has happened out over time. Although I do think when you understand that Israel still is the David, because she is surrounded by very powerful enemies with weapons and intention to destroy her on every side. She's definitely not the Goliath in that situation.
That's right.
If I could add one thing, just really quickly, also, I don't think a lot of people understand, and maybe I'm off on this, but I think there's a very deep-seated... Man, dog. Shush up. I think there's a very deep-seated amongst Arab countries about the idea of there being an independent Jewish state in the middle of traditionally now considered Arab lands where the Ottoman Empire was, and that it's okay to have... There were many periods where Jewish people lived in Arab lands in the dhimmi status, where they were protected. Certainly they were treated better than they were in the Byzantine Empire. But in the modern world, the idea of an independent, strong Jewish state right there in Arab lands. I don't know if there'll ever be this thing of accepting Israel's right to exist.
Right.
It'd be a major sticking point.
And that's the problem, Rob. It truly is. We've got to run because we're going to run out of time here, but thank you for calling. Our numbers, if we can sneak any more in, is 813-239-9663. And Simon in Lakeland, you are with us. Hello, Simon.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'll keep it very terse. With regard to the election this Tuesday, Moshe Figlon is going to be potentially a member of the Knesset. And so my view, it's not a process of peace for land. This is a religious war. And the reason it's a religious war is that if you look at the Christian doctrine, the Nostra Aetate from 1965 was that the Second Vatican Council finally came to the conclusion after 2,000 years that Jews were not responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. Piggyback that, juxtapose that thought with Muslims. There has not been a doctrine between Jewish people and Muslims with regard to their Jewish's rejection of the Prophet Muhammad. This has nothing to do with land. If it does, then why won't Jews be allowed to pray on the Temple Mount? Forget about the holies of holies. They will never be able to pray on the Temple Mount. This is a religious war, and you two are thinking Western thinking rather than thinking of thousands of years.
Well, I mean, I think that from the leadership of the people on the Palestinian side, there is great hatred for the Jewish people because they have a Jewish state and they don't think it has the right to exist. But I think for many of the average Palestinians that are living in the area, there is not the same hatred for Jews. They get along, many of them. Again, not Hamas and not Abbas and all,
Michael. Michael, Israel does not make a peace treaty with just the Palestinians. They also make a peace treaty with the Arab League.
Well, with the Arab leaders. So Simon, I mean, I guess a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, look, there is a religious war. I think the last caller mentioned the Dhimmi status, and we had talked about that when we had our caller on talking about our guest on talking about the Mizrahi project. You know, Jews have always been in Israel. They've always been in the Middle East. We've been there for thousands of years. What had happened, however, was under the rule of other countries, because we've been, you know, in other empires, et cetera, that have come and taken the territory, they were Dhimmi status under Islam, which means that they were second-class citizens. And so they never had a right to self-rule or power, authority, ability to defend themselves. And that was a major shift in the Middle East in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, which resulted in a lot of the Jews who had been living in some of these areas for hundreds, if not thousands of years, being kicked out of their home with nothing but their shirts on their back. So yes, that there is a religious war that goes on. There is a religious ideology that underlines a lot of the hatred towards the Jews in that territory. So, and I do think that there is more to it. I mean, we have time to talk about it at another point.
But we're running out of time. We got one more call we're going to try and get in. Debbie, you are calling from Bradenton. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. We're short on time, so keep it quick.
Okay. Well, basically, you know, I happen to be Jewish. I lived in Israel. And
we do too.
I grew myself. And look, I'm obviously pro-Israel in every which way, but I think contrary to, you know, what Simon has to say, I feel that a lot of it has to do with territory. I mean, we did come after the war in by the hundreds of thousands, and we came highly armed and very, very, very well. The Jews were really, really tired. My parents were survivors, too. We were tired of being slighted. We were tired of being harmed, persecuted, murdered. But what happened was, I think that for the Palestinians, I don't think it was religious war back then. I don't think we saw so many fanatical Jews or fanatical Muslims at that time. I think much more than a religious war, it's a territorial war, and they saw the Jews encroaching, and I hate to say it, but we did drive them out of the territory, so to a great degree. I mean, if you read...
Well, but we were attacked.
We were attacked by five Arab nations at that time who told the Arabs living in the land to get out because we're getting ready to strike. So that's,
I don't think we were attacked in the early 50s when we first arrived in 48 or...
No.
In 1948, we were attacked. In 1948, we were attacked by five Arab lands, our surrounding five Arab countries, who told the Arabs who were living there to get out because we're getting ready to attack. The Israelis were not well armed at all. They came with nothing but their shirts on their back. The Jews who were living in the Middle East and throughout Northern Africa didn't have anything when they came over with them as well. So
okay, I got to catch you off.
It was a miracle they won.
Our time's up. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
This is The Third Opinion. Thanks for being with us. See you next week, same time, same station. Have a great day, everyone.